Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking about the critical zone. Now, it's not a TV program. It's something much more important. It's about geology. It's the area from the top of the atmosphere all the way to what I call bedrock. All right, it's that little skin of the Earth. And, you know, I know very little. I know the surface. I know a little bit about the atmosphere, too. Our guest today is Jennifer Drouin. She's a professor of geological sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And, Jennifer, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much.
This is going to be fun. And before we get into the critical zone, your interest, which is environmental, it's geological, it's all sorts of things, how did you begin? What were those driving forces when you were a little girl that said, hey, science, geology, the Earth, whatever? Interesting.
Well, it's actually a bit of a family trade. I guess you could call me a faculty brat. My mother is a seismologist, so she studies earthquakes. And when I was born in Durham, North Carolina, she was a professor at the University of North Carolina. So I grew up in the halls of the geology department. She would go teach, and I would be so bored that I would rearrange the punch cards from her old computer codes.
Which, you were a favorite child,
oh,
I bet.
I was an only child, thank goodness. And so, in a sense, it's always been very familiar to me. And I was raised in a house where, you know, talking about astronomy or what kind of mineral that was or, you know, what sort of chemical reaction makes something change color.
You never really had a chance to branch out then, did you? That's rather unfair. You could have been a great musician.
I'm pretty sure I've definitively shown that that wouldn't be true. But yeah, it wasn't that I just, you know, never thought about it. I actually really enjoyed literature growing up and was a lit minor and as an undergrad and thought I might go and do something else. And in my explorations, I took a semester during my undergraduate training to go abroad, and I went to Australia. And it was really there that it finally sunk into me how important water is in this world that we live in. I took a trip across the center of the country, and, you know, if you drive across the middle of the United States, you see crops for as far as the eye can see, especially where I'm now in Illinois. And in Australia, you see nothing.
Did you go from Adelaide to Darwin or something like that?
Exactly.
Through Alice Springs?
We went right through the middle.
All right,
and,
lovely.
It was absolutely stunning. And it's not that there isn't water there, but what water is there is down deep in the ground, and it's salty. So it's very difficult to use. And in contrast, the water that's stored in the ground in the center of the United States is mostly fresh.
Well, that's interesting because salty water has got its utility. Mm-hmm. I mean, right here in West Texas and southern New Mexico, there's a couple at least of companies that are growing algae, where algae need saline conditions. So I think there are, as I remember from a previous program, there's three grades of water, maybe just in the state of Texas, and I'm going to call them A, B, and C.
Okay.
A means it's wonderful, you can just drink it straight out of the ground. B means you need to sort of clean it up, tart it up a little, and remove some of the minerals. And then C is just, you know, nothing to do. It's just too saline, ignore it.
Right.
But they use this type of saline water for growing algae, and they're doing very, very well.
Isn't that remarkable? And it gives you hope that there's not only some utility for this salty water that exists naturally, but also the salty water that we create as a byproduct of a lot of other resource development.
Now, but that salt can contain all sorts of things.
Yes, it's true.
Heavy metals, a little bit of uranium here and there,
right.
A little bit of lead, right? But we'll come on to that later. Mm-hmm. But so you just grew up, you know, in an environment where study of that type was appropriate and interesting. It wasn't even study.
It's true. It felt very natural. And in a sense, I have wondered as I've gone up through my own training the extent to which I'm just so comfortable in an academic environment and what it feels like if I hadn't, you know, for someone who hadn't grown up that way. You know, I have never had a problem barging into a professor's office when I was a student because, you know, I always had. And so I think I was sort of accidentally given
a favor. Your father also an academic?
He was, yeah. He almost finished his PhD and then I came along. So he actually became a high school math and science teacher North Carolina, and he's done a wonderful job at that for the past few decades.
Well, wonderful. So you grew up in Carolina, North Carolina,
yeah.
Durham. I went to the University of Durham in England,
actually. Oh, yes,
the first Durham, right. And did you do research as an undergraduate back then?
I did, and in fact, it was an aqueous chemistry lab.
Good.
And it was a community outreach project where individuals would sign up to volunteer, and they would go out and sample their local stream. And so you would send out sample kits, and they would send back a few different bottles with different preservations and reagents. And, you know, we would run some very basic analyses, pH, conductivity, you know, major ion content. And it was just basically keeping track of the chemical health of the Appalachian Mountains.
And the people were welcoming of you.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, they were volunteering. They would send the samples back to us rather than us having to go out and take 100 different samples. We had 100 different community citizens.
And everybody was happy that you were there.
Very much so. Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, you want to understand the quality of the water in your backyard, right?
It sounds sensible, but I mean, we've got a friend who does that right now in Texas, looking at the aftermath of hydraulic fracturing. And when he goes on their land and asks for permission to test their wells, sometimes he's met with a rifle.
I can imagine.
I mean, the times change and foci change also. So anyway, that was a beginning. And then you went to graduate school somewhere?
I did. So when I came back from Australia, I needed to know about water.
Okay.
And I very naively started searching for hydrology departments. This was how little I understood of what I was doing, that I didn't know that a hydrology department is not a very typical thing. Usually you learn hydrology within the context of a geology department or an engineering department, but I just wanted a hydrology department. And it turns out that there's only a few, and one of the very best ones is at the University of Arizona. And so I wound up in Tucson for 2 years doing a master's in the hydrology department there. And when I finished, I really wasn't sure, again, that I wanted to continue.
What was your research topic?
I was actually working on salinity in the Hueco Bolsón Aquifer in El Paso.
Okay, so you've been here before.
A long time ago.
So you've seen a change.
Yes, I can say so. I mean, I honestly landed last night, and I haven't even gotten to see the city yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing how it's changed.
Well, we still use the Hueco Bolsón. I mean, just last week we did a science studio with a fellow called Ed Archuleta. He was in charge of the El Paso Water District.
Okay.
And he's now retired, but he's associated with the university. So water here is a very big deal,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely.
And in fact, just for your own information here, we had a conference here on the title, I think, was One Water, Two Countries, One Border, something like that, which you immediately think it means Mexico and the United States. But it turns out these were people from Jordan and Israel, all right, because it was easier for them to come over here and talk about their mutual problem than it was for them to do it there.
My goodness.
Exactly. Well, anyway, now you're a faculty member. You got a PhD from Arizona or somewhere else?
I went to UC Berkeley.
Okay, not a bad place, I'm told. In fact, I know it well. So what did you do there?
Well, I started in the civil engineering department, kind of following the hydrology theme, but I got very interested in the chemistry of water. You know, I'd started looking at the salinity in the Hueco Bolsón here, and then had worked for a few months between degrees up in Colorado, where there's a lot of heavy metal contamination that's sort of a legacy of the Cold War era. And so I was working at some of these field sites, collecting samples and sending everything back to Berkeley. And eventually, you know, you send off so many sample bottles and you kind of want to know what's happening to them. And so I wound up starting a PhD at Berkeley and just wanted to work on that project more than I cared which department I was in. And it just wound up being the case that it worked best for me to be in the Earth and Planetary Science program.
So in the Colorado, I mean, a lot of, you say it was the legacy of the Cold War. So we're talking, is that Rocky Flats? Is that what we're talking about? That region outside of Denver somewhere?
Actually, a lot of the work that we've been doing is on the west side of the Rockies near Grand Junction. So there's a lot of contamination around Moab. Huh? And along that I-70 corridor.
And this is man-made in the sense that it's not a naturally occurring impurity in
the
water.
Well, it's an interesting situation, you know, because the reason that there was mining there in the first place is because there's naturally a large abundance of these kinds of metals in those mountains. And so the background content of metals in water in those areas is pretty high. But, you know, once you start taking it out of the ground and concentrating it and, you know, storing these tailings piles and these retention ponds, and you really create these hot spots of high metal content.
So you've just waltzed or segued into environmental science here, all right? I mean, that it's one thing to have a natural background. And I've heard arguments that people say, well, if it's a natural background, somewhere over a period of time, indigenous people who have lived there and people who have moved in later, maybe for hundreds of years, are somehow adapted to having a certain amount of that material already in their water, in their system, in their food maybe also. Is there any truth to that? Or is, you know, do some people tolerate these heavier metals better than others?
I'm not sure I can speak to the health component of it, but, you know, it's certainly true around the world that there are areas that have high and low concentrations of naturally occurring, or you might say geogenic, metal contamination. In the Colorado area in particular, you know, it might be the case that you could draw more water resources from surface water drainage, like the Colorado River itself, which tends to be much more dilute and snowpack driven than the aquifers that are discharging into the river and that have flowed through that sort of higher metal content porous media.
Have you been all the way down the Colorado River?
All the way. I've followed it through large sections. I love to river raft, and so I've been on some of the tributaries. I've done the Green River quite a lot. But I haven't made it all the way out to where it actually discharges, and I would really like to see that.
Because, I mean, it crosses the border from the United States to Mexico.
Right.
And then there are international agreements about how much salinity can the water be when it goes from the U.S. to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I remember that reverse osmosis was sort of really placed into play as a purification process, because they had to come up with some rationale and some experimental process for cleaning the water.
Right, exactly. It's interesting, you know, it was only 10 or 12 years ago now that I was doing my master's at Arizona, and the running line was that reverse osmosis and these, you know, desal capabilities were just, you know, untenable in terms of their cost.
Right.
And now, look, it's becoming, you know, commercialized and readily available. And it's not that the technology or the energy has gotten that much better. It's just that the demand for clean water has risen.
I'm trying to remember I think we produced, I'm going to make a guess here, 30 million gallons a day of purified water from a desalination plant here in El Paso using this reverse osmosis.
Isn't that wild?
I mean, just a million gallons seems enormous volume.
Right.
But 30 a day to around that purple park to satiate the appetite of El Paso.
It makes one wonder where they put all the salt.
I'm sure I could tell you that, but I'm not going to. I think it's a sort of a regional secret. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with Jennifer Druin. She's a professor of geology from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Jennifer Druin from Illinois, University of Illinois. And we were talking about the sort of formation of Jennifer, all the stuff that she did as a student and going on to get a career started. So now, what are you doing today? What are your hot issues today? Just give me a couple of them, because I think you're a pretty Renaissance lady.
Thank you. Well, as you mentioned earlier in the show, I've really been excited about this sort of emergence or maybe rediscovery of the concept of the critical zone. And so this is a focus that we've had in the past few years, thinking about a more coherent systems approach to the component of the planet that you and I live on and draw resources from and really require to survive. So that goes from coherent bedrock. And when I say that, I mean sort of the base of what could contain enough water that we could pump it. And then that moves all the way up through our aquifers, our groundwater reservoirs, into this partially saturated porous media and all the way up into soil. And in that soil, roots penetrate down and redistribute some of that water and nutrients and sustain ecosystems. And these are the same ecosystems that we grow food from. And moving up into the canopy of those ecosystems and the weather and the atmosphere, all of this is a coherent system.
Just explain that last one, the canopy region.
Yeah.
I think when you say canopy, I'm thinking of, you know, where the orangutans run around and stuff like that. But that means something different for you, I think.
Basically, the component of vegetation that is accommodating photosynthesis and moving nutrients and elements from the atmosphere down into the ground and back again, right?
Okay.
And so that can happen in a variety of different ecosystems. So we've been working with support from the National Science Foundation for the past few years at a set of critical zone observatories. And these are chosen across the country for their characteristics as an ability to instrument them and approach understanding their functioning in the systems level. And so the one that I've been working at the most is in Mendocino County in Northern California. It's a mature Douglas forest, Douglas pine ecosystem.
It's also a wine growing area, isn't it?
It is. It's a little bit further north than that.
Okay.
So if you remember or have an image of those beautiful huge trees that you couldn't possibly wrap your arms around, that's the place.
Lovely.
And it's a lovely forest hill slope. It's got shale underneath. It's uplifting quite quickly from a geologic perspective. So there's a lot of supply of new material from deep in the earth.
Well, just give us a number. When you say uplifting, can you, presumably nowadays with lasers and the rest of it, you could actually put a number to that. Is that a millimeter or a decade, 2 millimeters a decade?
What? Yeah, that would be about right. Yeah, that's
so
think about it kind of on the order of how quickly your thumbnail grows.
Okay.
This is a very geologically active place, as you know, right?
Yes.
Plenty of earthquakes happening in California. This area is sustaining this forest, and there's a really interesting wet and dry cycle where the seasons are Mediterranean. And so together, somehow, this system persists, and it makes its way through periods of terrible drought, as well as flood, and functions. And we're just beginning to start to understand how that system actually manages to do that, meaning that, for example, in the critical zone observatory that I work at, we're seeing that water is stored during the dry season actually above the water table in this partially saturated fractured shale, and that the trees are actually using that water resource to get through the dry period.
What's the depth of that?
Talking on the order of 15, 20 meters.
Okay.
Quite deep.
And so those enormous big trees, how deep does their root system go?
That's a good question, and it looks like it's about maximum 8 to 10 meters. So they're not getting all the way down to coherent bedrock. They're not even necessarily getting all the way down to the water table, but they're storing and using water in that subsurface to survive.
Okay.
It's really fascinating, and so as we, you know, begin to develop better models for how water moves through the planet, we're kind of missing this really critical, I shouldn't say critical because it's the critical zones, but we're kind of missing this really interesting cycle that's sort of been hidden from us until now.
I mean, that brings to the point that myself, I don't think about the water and the balsam very much, but if I did, I'd think of them as just sort of, there's one here, there's one there, and it's like filling your bath water, right?
Exactly.
And there it is. But in fact, what you're telling me is that there's a tremendous amount of migration. This water's flowing from one location to another to a certain extent.
There's a lot of redistribution, exactly. And there's also a lot of water above the water table, right?
Right.
It's not suddenly just wet to dry. There's a whole gradient. And that partially saturated part of the near surface is one of the aspects that this critical zone perspective is beginning to let us realize.
And how does that make us think about better doing our agriculture, for example, or does it not? Is that simply something that you can think about in Mendocino, but you haven't got enough information to know how that knowledge, that understanding, can be translated to Illinois?
I think it's actually something that we're just beginning to get our heads around. And so right now, we're looking at similar ecosystems to the eels. So, for example, we have another field site in Colorado outside of Crested Butte that's also shale-dominated, that also has mature forests at high elevation, and asking whether or not the same thing happens there. And that's a much more complicated system because of the snowpack. So we're just beginning to start looking for the extent to which this is a component of ecosystem sustainability and health in other areas. And so we begin by looking for sites that are comparable or similar in the way that they function to the Eel River critical zone. So we have a site outside of Crested Butte in Colorado that's also shale dominated, that also hosts a forest ecosystem, but at very high elevation. And we're asking whether or not these ecosystems sustain themselves in similar ways by storing that water above the water table and utilizing it seasonally. And ultimately, it, as you say, might be able to be translated into very different systems, like in agriculture, but we're not there yet.
I don't quite know where to go because there's so many questions I want to ask you. But I think you keep bringing up, well, you've brought up twice, the concept shale.
Yeah.
All right. And now most of the people listening to this program will think, aha, here we go.
Here we
hydraulic
go.
Fracturing or something along those lines. Tell us exactly what you as a geologist, as a hydrologist, as someone who's studied, what the definition of a shale is.
Okay.
Because that's not totally clear to everybody, and not me anyway.
Oh, right. So it's a sedimentary rock.
Right.
So there's sort of a gradient of accumulation of sediments through time and in shallow basins that results in either a large or small pore space, either high connectivity between the pores or low connectivity. And shale tends to be what we call tight rock, meaning that though it may have plenty of pore space, it's not very well connected. And what that means is that traditionally, you know, a few decades ago and longer, if you were to put a well into the ground and try and draw water out of shale, you'd have a really hard time. And so shale tended to be avoided, in a sense, in terms of water resources in favor of more permeable units like sandstones. And it's only been in the past few decades that, in fact, we've really started to interact with shales and other so-called tight rocks in new and exciting ways that we don't fully understand the implications for yet.
So, I mean, I understand then that within this shale, this tight rock, you've got embedded, encapsulated, I guess is a better word, materials,
right.
Fluids. And you mentioned water, but of course everybody thinks about hydrocarbons.
Right.
But and so we're utilizing this hydraulic fracturing nowadays to get hydrocarbons. Do people do that for water? Are there locations where, in fact, the water content of this shale is much more important than any hydrocarbon resource?
It's so hard to get out. And, you know, as you're familiar, I'm sure, when you frack shales, you really have to put a lot of energy into the process. And beyond just that, they're using all sorts of very interesting chemical cocktails to be
right.
able to propagate those fractures. And in doing so, you know, it's quite difficult to draw a water resource.
Right,
that could
and in
be
fact,
usable.
You have to pump a lot of water in order to
exactly,
release.
Exactly.
So I've answered my own stupid question there. Right?
No, but, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, as you point out, these shales have very unique fluid compositions and fluid chemistry in them. You point to the hydrocarbons, but, you know, we come back around to the metals again and the unique chemical signature of these tight rocks that it's been held there for so long. And suddenly we're opening them up and making them, you know, exposed to the rest of the critical zone, if you will. And so we're just beginning to try and ask from a more basic science question, what is the meaning of opening these tight rocks? How does that influence the rest of our Earth system?
The usual problem of unexpected consequences. We're very clever at doing experiments, but we don't always know what the outcome of the experiment is going to be.
It's an interesting time, one of many examples, I think, in human history where we're running our own test on our own planet in
right.
real time.
And we're leaving future generations to clean up if we if we make a bit of an error.
We'll see.
What's the most exciting thing you've discovered in the last few years? If I had to say, well, Jennifer, you've got all this great funding, you've got great students, you're a great university, you've got this palette, which is the critical zone in North America and other locations. What's the big discovery that you will tell your grandchildren if you have any?
I tell you, what I'm going to talk about is maybe not a discovery tied up in a nice bow, but is the new direction that I'm really excited about right now. I'm a groundwater hydrologist, and by nature, I have to have an imagination because you can't see groundwater, right? We're stuck to these little locations in space called wells, and we get to take little fluid samples in one point in time. And from that, we're supposed to understand these incredibly rich and diverse and complicated structures, chemically, physically. And so you have to have an imagination for how water moves through the subsurface, all the many different pathways it could take to get to that location, all of the chemistry that it's experienced along the way. And meanwhile, on a whole nother field, in a whole nother world, another scientific community has faced a similar problem, and that is the medical community wanting to understand how fluids move through the human body. And in that context, there's been remarkable development of radio tracer imaging capabilities. Uh-huh. And just in the last few years, we've started to apply that to rock.
So you can get permission to put a radioactive material down in a site and monitor its distribution later.
You know, what we do is the other way around. Actually, we'll take a core from a geologic formation and we'll put it into a specialized container, and we'll actually put it into these scanners. And so we can image them in the laboratory just like you would a human patient.
Okay.
And in doing so, we're really finally getting the first images of how flow moves through these 3D structures.
Because you're looking at the radioactive, or the isotopes, I shouldn't say radioactive all the time, but the isotope distribution that you saw in this core and following it through when you do poke holes into the ground in the wells.
That's
seeing,
the idea.
There we are. We're beginning to see a fingerprint, if you like, of that particular core.
Exactly, exactly. And if you can fingerprint that core, then maybe you can say something about how the larger system that that core came from functions.
Okay, fruits from this
labor. I certainly hope so.
Hey, it's been great talking to you, Jennifer. This is Science Studio. Again, Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you.